Hello, and welcome to the 86 Celtics Interviews podcast from CSNNE.com. I'm Abby Chin. During our series discussing the 1986 Boston Celtics, we've sat down with many players from that championship, along with members of the media that were close to the team. This week features a few of the opponents that were very familiar with the 1980s Celtics. First, we hear from Atlanta Hawks great Dominique Wilkins. Jim Aberdale, the producer of CSN's documentary on the 86 Celtics, sat down with Wilkins.
So just to start us off, Dominique, could you just tell us about where the 85-86 Hawks were as a whole, as a franchise? You guys finished 50-32. Fratello was the coach of the year, Kasten the executive of the year, but yet you guys had to use 17 different lineups in the regular season due to a lot of injuries, specifically to Doc. So where were you guys as a franchise that season?
We were good. We were very good. Despite the injuries, you know, to win 50 games in a season that era in the East, you know, was very, very tough. I mean, the East was a very physical, skilled, talented, you know, conference. I mean, there was no easy nights. And each one of those teams in the East had great, great players. Every night you was going against a Hall of Fame type player.
And you personally, talk about a little bit about your season. You were the scoring champion, 30.3 a game. First team all NBA and runner-up in MVP voting to Larry Bird.
You know, I remember Larry said that we both deserved to be MVP that year. He gave me the biggest compliment, says probably should have been you, get that MVP, you know, for what you did with that team. And that's the biggest compliment I think I can ever get from anybody. You know, from one of the greatest play the game to get that kind of a compliment was wonderful. But that was a great and tough season. And it was a great season because we accomplished, you know, what we set out to do, to win over 50 games. I think the tough part about it, we kept running up against the Celtics. That was the roughest part of that year. They were so good. They had five Hall of Famers on that team. I mean, they were good. I mean, they were a great, great team. And I felt like if I didn't bring it every night, if I didn't score 30-plus every night, it's hard for us to win. And it was. I mean, that team had so many weapons.
You and Larry, it's like, you know, obviously Magic was out west, but for the Eastern Conference, it was you and him. Can you just tell us a little bit about him? He was your rival.
Oh, boy. We had a lot of fun battles, man. And, you know, the thing about Larry and I, you know, that's when you can tell when you have rivalries going. We didn't ever talk to one another. We rarely even shook hands. You know, that's how intense the rivalries were at that time. And Larry developed a lot of respect for me, and of course I had a lot of respect for him. And so we knew going into each one of the games that it was going to be a battle. Every game. It wasn't no games that we said we go in, it's going to be an easy game. You know, you knew you playing against the Celtics, it's going to be a tough road, and they knew playing against us, we was going to put up a tough fight with them. It wasn't going to be an easy night. And that went on for years, but particularly that year, we had some great battles.
And what was he like on the floor just with his legendary talker?
Well, early on my rookie year, he talked quite a bit, you know. I remember a situation where I went to shake his hand, wouldn't shake my hand, and he looked at me and said, I don't even know why they got you guarding me, and hits a three. Then he comes down the very next play, said, you don't even belong in this league. I don't know why they got you guarding me. He hits another three. And I remember getting very mad, and I told the guard, you see me on the wing, pitch me the ball. And I remember going to the basket, and I threw one down. On him, and I think that's when I got my respect, because he didn't get under my skin. But as we started to, you know, compete against one another, he developed a lot of respect for me, and because he knew that I was going to come at them, and he was going to come at us, and so the mutual respect we had for one another set up for those epic games.
So the 85-86 season, you guys lost 32 games, 150, as we talked about. Six of those losses, so almost 20%, were against the Celtics. And you averaged, I was looking at these box scores, 35 a game in these six games. So you were playing great. And talk about your mentality.
Well, the thing is, I never had another great player in their prime to play with. And so, again, if I didn't get 30-plus a night, it was tough for us to win. And, you know, Bird, he had some what we call real dogs that played with him, like Kevin McHale, Robert Parris, Danny Ainge, Dennis Johnson. And then their bench, they had a solid bench with Walton and all those guys. And so they had guys that can come at you, you know, at a lot of different positions. So, but people ask me all the time, if it's something you would change, you know, playing against that team. And I always tell them, not a thing. I wish we could play it over again. And the outcome may have been different. You know, that was just the intensity that we played with against each other. That was a great time to be a part of NBA basketball.
How frustrating was it for you back then to deal with this and keep coming up against these guys?
You know what I always said? If we could have made it by the Celtics that year, I felt we'd have won the championship. But we just couldn't get by them. Actually, we should have won in game six. We should have ended that series in game six, and we blew a golden opportunity. I think we lost that game by two at the end of the game on a kind of an errant shot by somebody that shouldn't have took the shot. But I felt if we got by them that year, we'd have won it all. And I felt like if they'd have kept that team together another year, we could have won it. You know, because playing against the Celtics taught us something. It taught us how to win. It taught us how to stay focused. And because that team has won so many championships. And so they taught us how to stay focused and ready. And I felt like, even though we lost that series, coming into next year, I felt like we could have won it all.
Could you talk a little bit about the makeup of that Atlanta team in 85, 86, some of the guys that you did play with and what their, you know, what the team makeup was, the philosophy?
Well, I played with some tough players back then. Kevin Willis, who was a force, he was our enforcer on that team. You had Doc Rivers and Tre Rollins and Randy Whitman, Spud Webb, John Battle. I mean, we had Antoine Carr, Clifton. We had some players. We had some guys who were tough, gritty, 9-to-5 type of guys that they put it on the line every night. But again, I needed that one other superstar to get over the hump, because you had to work that much harder against five Hall of Famers as opposed to one. You know? So, again, I had to be on top of my game every night.
On January 18th, it was the fifth of six meetings. Mm-hmm. It was a game at the Omni, largest crowd in franchise history at the mm-hmm. time. The Lakers mascot called Dancing Barry showed up there or something. Mm-hmm. It was in this book last night I was reading about. You guys went up 70-47 in the second quarter, but lost 125-122 in overtime. I guess the Celtics went in, they were silent at halftime. Casey didn't say a word to him, but there was trash talking on your guys' end, one player in particular. Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, I remember. It was Kevin Willis. It was Kevin Willis. I love Kevin. But, you know, you don't want to awaken a sleeping giant. And I think that's what happened. And they were like, don't let this so-and-so score anymore tonight. I'm like, what are you doing? And Bird saw that, right? And it's like his eyes got so big, and I knew it was going to be a battle from that point on. I knew it was going to be a battle. It was going to come down to who was going to win in the fourth quarter.
And from what I think Doc had said to us also, so it might have Kevin Willis and I guess Eddie Johnson also.
Eddie Johnson was always talking trash, so it was nothing new with him. A lot of times, Eddie was, we always go, not in his right frame of mind, but he was a hell of a player. Hell of a player, fast Eddie Johnson, man. He was something. But when you're playing against a team like that, to have so many great players, and so many great players who've been in the trenches, who've been battle tested, who've won championships, man, you know, you play your game, you play hard, but you keep your mouth shut. I've never been a trash talker, that type of guy. I let my game speak for itself. I didn't have to talk about it. But Eddie, at that time, too, was one of the guys that just loved to talk all the time, you know. And it kind of got us in trouble.
Go forward from January. We're going to go to February now, the All-Star Weekend of 86. First, tell us just about the dunk contest. I know you had won in 85, mm-hmm. and then your teammate won in 85. Was it the first one that you won in 85?
The first one I won, I believe it was 85, yes.
Tell us about that and then watching your diminutive teammate win it in 86.
See, the one in 85 was, I wanted to set my mark, you know. It was more entertainment than anything else. I think a lot of people put too much stock in us preparing for the dunk contest. I never prepared for it. Stuff I did in dunk contests, I did in games. So I didn't have to prepare or go practice in the gym. All that happened as I went through the contest, believe it or not. So I knew the type of impact that that would have because I had the same impact in games. So I didn't practice that stuff. And I kind of knew I was going to win it, to be honest with you. Going into the dunk contest with Spud the following year, Spud lied to me. I tell him all the time he lied to me. I said, you've been practicing some of that stuff. There's no way that you can do that at your size and with that type of timing and not been practicing. He like, yeah, I practiced a little bit. I'm like, you practiced a whole lot. But I was really happy for him because we were best friends. So it didn't bother me that he won. I was happy that he won. You know, I probably did cheer for him as much as anybody to do well.
And what do you remember about observing Bird in the inaugural three-point contest?
Oh, well, what was said when he went in the locker room, he said, which one of you guys going to take second place? And when he went on, he put on a shooting expert. To me, it's still the greatest three-point contest I've ever seen. Because the way it all was, it came about, you know. It was staged. It couldn't have been staged any better. And then the comment before the game, before that contest, and to him to do what he did, unbelievable.
Were you surprised, or was everybody in that locker room? I mean, being in that all-star locker room, you get all that all-star talent, and then Bird, you know, proclaiming that. Was that surprising to you?
Nah, that's who he is. I mean, Bird says things to get in your head, to get you thinking. I mean, that my rookie year, he did that to me a couple times until he saw that I was a guy that wasn't going to be rattled. And then that's when you get your respect from a guy like him. So going into that contest, you know, that was just to see how tough you are, see what your mindset is. And when he said that, you get to thinking, well, maybe I might take second place, you know, and it worked. And but more importantly than that, the shooting exhibition that he put on, I mean, come on. How many people have you ever seen do that the way he did it? That's the best to me.
And afterwards, he said he'd take that 10 G's and donate it to the Larry Bird Fund.
And it wasn't about money with him. It was never about money with Larry. Larry loved to compete, period. I mean, here's the guy that you look at the small forwards, and people think Larry Bird maybe 6'6", 6'7". He was a big small forward, 6'9", 6'10", playing small forward to shoot the ball like that. Within traffic, not a guy that's shooting by himself. He was a guy who could make you pay with double teams, triple teams at times. He was just that good.
Well, first of all, tell us about the first round that year you guys beat the Pistons, and Fratello finally had his starting lineup in place, and that was 23-5 when he had that starting lineup. You guys were healthy and you beat the Pistons. What do you remember from that season?
Well, that Pistons series was a tough series. You know, it was a good series, but it was a hard fought. It was very physical. And we got out of that series, you know, convincingly. We beat the Pistons, you know. But it was, again, it was an exciting series. So, again, coming into that Boston series, we felt really good coming into that series that we could beat them. But we had to be on top of our game. We had to play pretty much a flawless game, no mistakes, because that team thrives off your mistakes, the Celtics. And so if you made a lot of mistakes against them, you didn't win, period.
So in that series, you guys went down 0-3. You won game four to avoid a sweep down there in Atlanta. Came back up here for game five. So in the third quarter of game five, you guys were outscored 36-6. And it's been called the perfect quarter of basketball. Danny said recently the way basketball is supposed to be played. What did it feel like to be on the other side of that when this great team was having pretty much their greatest quarter?
Well, you know, you look at a situation like that and you said, you know what, we didn't play our best quarter. We didn't do the things that got us here. We didn't do the things that what we do best. So we had to kind of weather the storm and come back, you know, out and play the type of basketball that we were accustomed playing, that Hawk style of basketball, you know, up-tempo, running physical, get it inside, play the inside-out game. But we didn't do that in that quarter. You know, we just kind of got, it was like we were stuck in mud. And they put on a clinic in that quarter. They really did.
Also in that quarter, I wanted to see if you remember this sequence where Tree Rollins was so frustrated, he threw the ball at Danny off an inbounds pass. Danny caught the ball, laid it in, and handed it back to Tree, who was still standing.
I don't remember. I remember him getting frustrated. I don't remember that exact play, but I remember him getting frustrated. Well, he always got frustrated at Danny. Danny kept him frustrated, you know. So he got under Tree's nerves, you know. He really got under his skin. But I don't quite remember how that whole developed, but I just know he got angry at him. I mean, because we were getting blown out in that quarter.
And what was just in the huddles at that point? You know, there's some quotes from Fratello saying all you can do is call timeout, make substitutions. The league doesn't allow you to make trades during games. And what was just
that's a good one. But you know, the thing is, you know, Mike was always a guy that was always he was optimistic. He was tough. And you know, the thing is that you know you got to keep playing. Got to keep playing. Don't stop playing. You know, if you keep playing, good things will happen. Good things will happen. Just keep playing. You know, we made a lot of mistakes, but we can't blame anybody. We're still in the heat of the battle. So
the perception for you, I mean, you were always going at Larry. You guys are kind of at each other. But for the rest of the team, guys like Danny, how frustrating was it to deal with that type of a player, like that personality type of a player?
Well, Danny was a pest. There's no question about it. We love to hate him. You know, and Danny and I was talking about this the other night, but it was just the way we played basketball. You know, you tried to find an advantage and leverage, and you try to win the game by any means necessary. And Danny was one of those guys that got on your skin time and time again. He and Doc Rivers would go at it a lot. He and Randy Whitman would go at it. So we had different guys that, you know, had their different differences with Danny. But Danny did a great job at getting under people's skin, because he knew if he can get on your skin, he got you. And so, you know, a lot of people talk about the great Celtic team with Bird and Magic. I'm sorry, with Bird and McHale and Parris. But Danny Ainge was a major part of that team, because he was a guy who could shoot the lights out. He could defend, and he got on your skin. Those are things he did, and he did it well.
Just speaking of, again, other Celtics guys, we've talked about a lot about Larry and Danny. What about just the other part of the big three as opponents? Kevin, if you can go through, and then Robert.
Well, if you got by Larry, you had them other 2 7-footers to contend with. You know, so if you scored against that team, you earned everything you got, because those big 7-footers defended around the basket. Most times, McHale guarded me, most times. You know, so he was, even though, I mean, I still scored, but it was a hard 30 or 40 that I got. But he was so long that he could stretch you out enough where he could catch up with me, because he was so long. And so it would give Bird the opportunity or ability to rest a little more at times, you know. So it was a solid strategy on their part.
And what about Robert?
Robert, never seen a smile a day in his life. But, you know, Chief was, he was a great defensive player. He was very good around the basket. And that, when you're talking about guys who posted up and held their position, he was wonderful post-up player, and he was a great help defender. You know, so again, that team, it was like a chain. Everybody's pulling in the same direction, you know, and this was consistently all the time. It wasn't that they do this from time to time. I mean, they had, you know, they won 60 plus games. That was a great team, and so he was a major part of that team. That big front line, I mean, you don't see the front lines that big anymore. That was a huge front line. You got Bird at 6'10", McHale at 7 foot, Parris at 7 foot. That's a big front line.
The golden era of the NBA, like, you guys were kind of it. Like, that mid-80s era of the NBA was just super talented.
It was super talented. That era was, I mean, I don't think people really understand how good that era was and how great some of them players. And you look at teams was great, but some individual players, that was just so good. I mean, guys made you play defense. I mean, you had to guard those big guys on the block. Yeah, Larry could shoot the three. He could shoot mid-rangers. He could do it all. But he was a hell of a post-up player. Parris was a hell of a post-up player. McHale was a man of 1,000 moves, as we should call him back in those days. I mean, you had to double everybody on that team as far as post players. You know, you weren't playing them one-on-one. And so it was just so skilled. And you had to be able to match their will every night. And so my whole mission, well, I'm coming at you tonight. I don't care who you got guarding me. I'm coming at you tonight. It's going to be a battle. And unfortunately, Bird was saying that on the other end. Set up for some great games, man.
And I think one of the things Torrey's kind of alluding to is we do this project, you know, I'm 40, he's 37, we were 10, 7 back then. But some of these young cats out there on Twitter and different, they don't get it that it was you and Michael and Magic and Ewing and Larry and just
Elijah One, English, Dantley, Bernard. It's too many guys, you know, every night. I mean, you was playing against some of those big centers back in those days. They weren't shooting threes. They was posting you up, beating you up in the paint. And those big centers, some of them were scoring 20, 25 points a night. Akeem Olajuwon, man, unstoppable big man. These guys were big and strong. And so I just don't think these young kids really understand how great them players was in that. And I mean, here's a guy like Clyde Drexler, a lot of people don't even talk about, who was a super player, you know. And Karl Malone. I mean, you can go down the line with great players. And I say this all the time. I never feared anybody I ever played against. One guy made me nervous, and that was Bernard King, because he was a machine. I knew he was going to get 40, and nothing I can do about it. So I used to say to myself, you know what? I get 40, he get 40, we just call it a wash. I'm not going to kill myself chasing this guy. But that's how it was. Bird the same way. I mean, Bird was an anomaly at that position, because he was really a power forward with a small forward mentality, because he was strong, he was gritty, tough, had a heart of a lion, and basketball IQ off the charts. And so he found ways to beat you, period.
Do you think as a whole, just that group in the 80s basketball, it was more competitive and harder than it?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. It was about the competition, being in that competitive mode. It wasn't about no money. We all made money, but we all liked to play. And we never stopped playing. I mean, guys on the summer, and Bird used to do this with us. We used to travel in the summer playing basketball games in the summer. All the top players in the league played summer basketball, traveled around with Magic Johnson playing basketball. We didn't go work out. We went to play. And that's what makes you better as a player. When you can go and play against the best every day, you can't help but get better.
On 88, just 28 years later, people still talk about that constantly. You bring us through all.
You know what? I used to get really mad and upset that people keep bringing that game up, because we lost the game. Even though it was an unbelievably competitive game and you had two guys who matched each other's will. But, you know, when I think about it now, it's like, wow, people still talk about that game all these years later, which means that it was a historical game. We didn't know we was making history. Neither one of us did. And now when people talk about a game, it's almost like a blessing. You know, it's like it's fun to talk about, because here's 20 plus years later, people still talking about that series and that one game with Larry and I, which means it meant a lot. And it showed that two guys who refused to lose. Unfortunately, one of us had to go. I remember Bird said that in the game. He said, we both deserve to win, but one of us have to go home. I remember that to this day. And again, I think that series taught me something as a player, but it also it gave me the respect that I thought I deserved, and that came from Larry Bird.
And just talk about what was going through your mind as you guys were going mano a mano back and forth.
Well, again, Kevin Willis got him hot in the third quarter when he said, don't let this so-and-so score anymore tonight. And I think Cliff Livingston was in the game, and Bird's eyes got bigger than life. And that's when it started. So Coach, time to go back in the game. I mean, we can't let this game get away from us. And the only thing that went through my mind is that I got to keep us close. And so I just told Doc Rivers, I said, give me the ball and get the hell out of the way. And that's what set up that quarter. And he did the same, you know, because every time down, that ball ended up in his hands. And he made something out of nothing. At times when you thought you had him pretty much contained, he made something happen offensively. I've never seen anything like that. I was in the zone. I said, look, just don't worry about running plays. And I told Doc, I said, just come down, we run the play, give me the ball and just move. And I said, I'll take care of it from here. And it went that way the whole quarter. And it came down to, and I tell you what, the very end of the game, a very smart play by Danny Ainge. Because I was so hot that game that he thought that if I would have launched one from half court that I would probably make it. And that's the way I was feeling. And so when I advanced towards half court, he tackled me before I got into shooting mode. And so it sent me to the line instead of me taking a chance to making a three to win the game. And that's how it actually it was to tie the game, actually. if I would have made that shot. But it was a smart play on his part to realize that. And he told me this the other day. He said, Casey, he said, why the hell you tackle him for? You know, he's like, you want a two or take a chance of him knocking down a three to tie this game and going overtime? He's like, oh, okay. So I end up missing. I made the first free throw, and I missed the second one on purpose to try for us to get a tip or something. And that's how that game ended.
And the last one for me, just back to, again, our 86 documentary in particular, you played against a lot of great individual teams over your career. Where would you rank this 86 Celtics team?
One of the greatest of all time. So I have to rank them in the top five without hesitation. That team was something. People don't remember, again, we don't know how good that team was. That team was a super team. You know, and Bird was the head of the snake.
Up next, we hear from former Celtics head coach Doc Rivers, who of course played point guard for the Hawks during their rivalry years with the Celtics. Doc talks with us about the 80s being the golden era for the NBA.
I'm asked a lot whether 80s the golden age, and you know, when you're in it, you don't know it. You just know it just seems like every night there's a great player, or every night there's a superstar that you're playing against. You know, playing the Boston Celtics when I was with the Hawks, you felt like they had three of them. You know, when you look at Bird, Parrish, and McHale, you're like, I mean, every night when you looked at that team and that group together. But then you just had so many players, Magic playing, Dr. J ended his career, Ewing's coming in, Jordan's coming in. It was just a spectacular area, a stretch to play basketball. And being a part of that was great, or bad timing. I'm not sure. I told someone that recently. I'm not sure if that was good timing. I'd rather have come later, you know, where it was easier in some ways. But what I did like is how competitive it was, you know, every night. I felt like you had to strap it on. It was a war.
Your Atlanta Hawks at that time, you know, you have Dominique, Spud. What was that team like in 85, 86, if you can recall?
I thought our team in 85, 86 was really good. But when you looked around, you knew Detroit was there. You knew the Celtics were there. You knew Philadelphia was still around. You know, you felt like we were really good, but we were really young. And wasn't sure if we were good enough or mature enough to beat the Celtics, you know, and that was the team you wanted to beat. You know, they were good and mature. They were good and smart, you know, and they were a team. And I thought it's still, no matter what the region or the time, it still goes back to Red in a lot of ways. I mean, Red Auerbach's stamp on the Celtics still lives. It really does. It lived through me. I guarantee it's living through Brad, lived through Casey Jones, lived through Tommy Heinsohn and Bill Fitch. And I just think what he accomplished was to prove that you could put a lot of talented players and everyone would give up themselves and become a Celtic. And that's what it was about. And that's why it was tough to beat the Celtics.
So the mystique was kind of real in some regard.
They did have a mystique. You know, it wasn't a Boston Garden. You know, someone told me, hey, is it tough playing the Garden? I said, I'll play the Garden all day. I don't want to play Mikal, Parrish, and Bird. That was our problem.
Specifically on a couple of occasions, there was a game, and if you don't remember, by all means, yeah. this is some nerd stuff at this point, but there was a game on January 18th and 86 between you guys. And you guys had a 27-point lead. There was a lot of smack talk in that game.
I remember that game, yeah. There was a game, we were at home, had a big lead, and Eddie Johnson, the little guard on our team, got into it with Bird and McHale, I think, walking off the floor. I didn't know anything about it. Unbeknownst to me, we come out in the second half, and you could see right at the beginning, there was some stuff going on. And they came back and won the game, and Bird was brutal with his trash talk. And I found out right after the game that Eddie Johnson was talking trash, and we learned the lesson. You know, don't wake up the sleeping dog, and we woke him up.
Awesome. And then let's go on to the conference semifinals. You guys find yourself in a tough situation against them. They're red hot at that point. Specifically, I don't know if you're familiar with the perfect quarter in the game five. Do you remember that game specifically and what it was like to just, they just kind of dominated at that point. What was it like to watch that unfold?
Well, it was no fun. I mean, they were just good, and they made every, I mean, it's one thing. It's like when a great player gets in a zone. That was like a great team getting into a zone. When a great player gets in a zone, they're already great, but then when they get into a zone, they're able to go somewhere else. And I thought playing them at times, they would go somewhere else. And you couldn't go there. You know, you knew your team couldn't go there, and it was a humbling experience.
Great. And then lastly, Peter May, I don't know if you remember Peter.
Oh,
He wrote the book that in the third quarter of that game, the perfect quarter. There was any, like, memorable stuff that took place afterwards, because you guys tried to come back from that, and it was really kind of a grinded out series, even though it was like basically Peter gave you guys a lot of credit for sticking with them, and it just wasn't happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's rare, at least for me, when I leave a series and I'm like, we played really well, you know, and we never gave up. We never stopped fighting them. But at the end of the day, they were just better. You know, they made the shots they had to make. I mean, I thought for us, I thought that was the start of our franchise. Like, I thought we were about to take off, because I thought we stared at that time the devil in the eye and fought him and stood right up to him, but it was just a little short. And I thought from being a player with the Hawks, we were about to start doing that. We just never could get there. We were just never that good.
Finally, the director of the 86 Celtics documentary, Torrey Champagne, was able to talk with Lakers great James Worthy about the greatest rivalry in NBA history.
The premise of this, and the reason why I really wanted to talk to you for this whole thing, is just the amount of battles that you guys had, mm-hmm. and kind of the history there with, you guys unfortunately lose in 84, mm-hmm. but then you win in 85, and you're the only team to kind of dominate the Celtics on their home court in history in the finals. What was that like for you guys to kind of exact your revenge?
Well, it was a great achievement. You know, we knew we were representing ourselves, particularly after losing in 1984. We were representing not only ourselves, but all those guys that lost to the Celtics in the 60s. You know, Jerry West, Wilt Chamberlain, Baylor, Happy Harrison, all those guys. So we knew it was a big, big accomplishment, and the only team ever to win a championship on the parquet floor in Boston. So there was a lot of redemption, a lot of revenge. We felt like 84 should have been ours. You know, an errant pass by me in game two kind of gave them a new breath of life. They beat us in overtime and went on to win a seven-game series. So, yes, it was a tough series, particularly after the first game. They think they beat us by over 30 points, still known as the Boston Massacre today. So a big rivalry, and you know, one that we felt we had to put some closure to.
The following preseason, an interesting fact as we've done our research on kind of the way things played out, is the NBA lined you guys up to play each other four times in the preseason. Would never happen today, mm-hmm. but it just adds to the whole rivalry or the thirst for more of a Celtics-Lakers thing. I think people are anticipating it was going to be you guys in the finals.
Well, I think, you know, Commissioner Stern, saw a diamond in the rough with the resurgence of the NBA. Didn't really have a great reputation in the late 70s. And then Magic and Bird come, East Coast, West Coast, Blue Collar, Showtime. I don't think that was by accident. I think he really conjured up a big promotion. Had a big television contract that year, I think, with CBS. And that big rivalry needed to propel, really, the NBA, along with Dr. J and a lot of other great superstars. But the year we played them four times, I was like, what? I couldn't believe it. And they, you know, we've played them twice out here and twice on the East Coast, and it felt like playoff games. So at that moment, I knew that it was a rivalry in the making, and one that that was pretty pretty potent during the 80s.
What were your thoughts as this whole perpetuated Boston Big Three of McHale, you know, the terminology? It seemed like you guys probably had your own out here on the West Coast that was pretty damn good. Yeah. You know, what was that like to kind of have
there's so much attention at that time in 86 keep kind of going back towards Boston as the greatest team, where they're going to achieve 70 wins or anything like that?
Well, they were good. I mean, they did have a big three. I mean, Robert Parrish, one of my favorite people of all times, with Larry and Kevin. And, you know, the big three could have been DJ, Mikel, and Bird. I mean, they had a lot of combinations. At least my favorite combination would have been DJ, Bird, and maybe Parrish. That's my big three, you know. So it didn't really bother us. You know, we had our goals and our missions, and we were focused. We knew each year whatever team was in the playoffs was going to get most of the attention. They still have more titles than we do, I believe. So we think in those modes. We had a chance to, you know, play them again in 87. We were just focusing on that decade. 85 was behind us, and we were trying to move on.
One of the things, and I was talking to Bill, like I said, I was with Bill Walton the other day for this project, and one of the things that we talked about was, you know, how his resurgence. I mean, you saw him a lot while he was with the Clippers, or actually you probably didn't see him that much because he was on the bench. Yeah. To see him go to Boston, add that piece, and you guys must have been saying, oh, man, I don't know what that's going to play out to be, but then to see him be healthy and play as well as he did, was that surprising to you?
It was. I saw Bill when he was in Portland, actually, in 1977 when he won a championship. Knew he was an awesome player. Also knew of his injuries over the years, particularly when it came to the feet. So it was awesome to see him, you know, work hard, you know, almost come out of retirement, because a lot of people thought he was done as far as being able to have impact. And so going to Boston and being around other great players too, I think kind of gave him that feeling that he could, you know, be important, part of something big. And he was a great center. John Wooden says the best college center he's ever coached. So I love Bill. He's a great guy. We do some things together. It was good to see him, you know, have a resurgence. I just hated that it was with the Celtics.
You know, everyone, again, anticipated that it would be L.A. and Boston in the finals, and it kind of felt like everyone wanted another shot at each other. You know, those conference finals against the Rockets, I think everybody was just thinking you guys were going to breeze through. What kind of happened in that conference finals, or were you in, what was it about the Twin Towers that changed things?
They were really good. They were well coached, and they were really good. An old Celtic coach, I believe, Bill Fitch, was at the helm. And they had other players. Rodney McRae was an amazing defensive player. Robert Reed, and they had Lloyd and Wiggins. They were deep, and they were difficult, and they had a style that was similar to ours. And Akeem Olajuwon had emerged as just a, you know, just one of the best centers ever, along with Ralph. So maybe we were. Think a little bit beyond the conference finals. Probably thought we were going to win that. And then I remember them beating us the last time we played them in regular season. And I kind of felt something about that team, that they thought they had our number. And they did. They matched up well. And it was very disappointing that we didn't get a chance to play against the Celtics once again in 86. It's a tough loss.
The Ralph Sampson last second shot haunt you a little bit?
The 84 loss to the Celtics haunts me more than that 86. 86 was a fluke, just a weird shot. But the 84, you know, Celtic, that's probably my fourth championship that I'll never forget that one.
You know, you yourself a legendary career, one of the 50 greatest players of all time. There's a lot of legends from that era. You talked a little bit of, you know, coming out of the 70s, the NBA really needed it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the golden age. A lot of people attribute it to the golden age. Is that an accurate assessment about that time, that period, those mid-80s?
I think so. I mean, because there was no consistency. There was no, you know, there wasn't a drug policy in the NBA. They had no television contract, really. You know, it had bad image of drugs and you know, coming out of the ABA merging, it was difficult times. And so I think when Commissioner O'Brien retired and Commissioner Stern came in, he had a different vision. He changed a lot of things, made the league accountable. And then television bought into it, and he had Bird and Magic. So I think it was the golden era. I know, you know, people might argue that, you know, Jordan in the 90s, but, you know, Jordan was also part of the 80s as well. just, you know, had a tough time getting by Detroit. So, yeah, for me, I'd take that era, you know, over. I mean, I remember Russell playing a little bit. I was young. But as far as the diversity and the parity, I would take that era over. I mean, there were some other good teams. I mean, Philadelphia, I mean, there was a lot of teams that couldn't beat Philadelphia, the 83 team. San Antonio was good. Utah with Stockton and Malone, so yeah.
Make sure and look for new episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays on CSNNE.com or by subscribing to our iTunes feed. And while you're on iTunes, please leave us a rating and review if you've enjoyed this podcast series. I am Abby Chin. Thanks so much for listening to another episode of the 86 Celtics Interviews.